You're listening to The Bulletin with UBS, first broadcast on the 7th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're talking oil prices. We're asking, why might sustained low prices, on the face of it a good thing, particularly for consumers, be such bad news? There are a range of factors that suggest that this time is different, and our experts and analysts will be making sense of them. We'll consider too some of the other potential implications and assess whether some commonly held concerns about low oil could in fact be unfounded, from fears to cuts in investment to US credit market jitters, from pressure on the renewable sector to the big picture geopolitical fallout. Low oil prices certainly provide plenty of talking points. So let's get started. We begin with Paul Donovan, Deputy Head of Global Economics at UBS Investment Bank. Paul explains why low oil might in fact be a bad thing and what makes this time so different.
Lower oil prices have a neutral effect on the global economy, because what you're doing is taking money away from one group, oil producers, and giving it to another group, oil consumers. So in that sense, what you're doing is simply shuffling money around the planet. What has happened, however, in the wake of the current lower oil prices is that we have seen a sharp slowdown in capital spending in the oil industry in the United States. And this has been a fairly important source of economic activity over the last couple of years. So whilst the lower oil price in theory should be a benefit to the US consumer, it has led to lower amounts of investment in the US economy.
Paul Donovan. And there are two key things to bear in mind when looking at what makes this time different, according to Jeffrey Yu, ultra high net worth investment strategist for UBS Wealth Management.
Two things, one on the consumer side and one on the financial market side. On the first point, we just haven't seen consumers spending the money that they're supposedly saving. So if you look at savings rates in the US, for example, in the past, households barely saved anything. Now these numbers are starting to go up, which is good in a way, given households have been over-leveraged for several years now, especially in the run-up to the financial crisis. But on the other hand, in a very constrained global demand environment, this is not something that policymakers are welcoming right now. So the trick is, you know, how to generate enough of a sentiment pickup for them to start consuming and to spend, you know, some of the money that oil has saved. Unless some of that's resolved, then lower oil prices, we can go down to zero. But if people just choose to save the money, then it's not really going to help the global economy. Secondly, on the financial market side, so there's been a lot of shale-related issuance, in particular in the US, over the last few years, concentrating the high-yield sector. And now there are concerns about the ability for these companies, the viability and their ability to refinance, for example. So, you know, that's leading to severe widening in spreads in that area. And there is a fear that given the Fed is hiking interest rates, there's going to be infection into other markets in terms of liquidity, and it could cause wider ramifications. So we think the second point is probably a bit overdone to some extent. So yes, you know, there are mine concerns here and there, but overall, I think like some of the default rates, for example, are just well, way over bearish right now. And ultimately, it's only about 11% of the high yield market, so it shouldn't result in any systemic issues.
And we asked Simon Smiles, UBS Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth, why he feels this time is different. Look at how sharp the fall has been, explained Simon.
I think what's different this time is how sharply oil prices have fallen against a backdrop of still relatively robust economic growth. If oil prices were $10 lower than last year, it would be a clear tailwind for markets. The fact that they've fallen as sharply as they have, and the stress that's put on different parts of the economy, oil services among them, has been the proximate cause of some of the weakness we've seen to date. You then look at the fundamental implications this has for US high yield, with a relatively large exposure to energy-related companies, which in the large have been relatively indebted. Those companies are fundamentally coming under stress from the lower oil prices. And then more recently, you've got a third leg to the fear trade, if you will, with respect to oil, which is less fundamental. And it's a growing perception, perhaps incorrectly, at least in our view, growing perception that oil at these levels, and such low levels compared with where they've been more recently, signals something about demand or a lack of demand globally, rather than signaling fundamentally an oversupplied market. So that concern, that fear about what $30 oil means with respect to deflation, what it means with respect to end demand, I think is a cause of the market weakness we've seen more broadly in financial markets this year.
And we got a perspective too from China. Angus Griggs, the correspondent for the Australian Financial Review based in Shanghai. Given that China is a major importer of oil, his take on what's different this time around is interesting.
Well, I think part of the story of the globally lower oil prices is the fact that the Chinese economy is slowing, and it is slowing possibly a little faster than people thought. And China's the largest buyer of oil. So clearly the world is looking to China for a demand story for oil, which hasn't really been delivering. In terms of what it's doing for the Chinese consumer or the Chinese economy, well, it's actually a more positive story. China is the biggest exporter of finished and manufactured goods in the world, so obviously lower shipping rates are a pretty positive thing for Chinese exporters and indeed consumers in the West. At the same time, China's a big importer of oil, so lower oil prices are a very good thing for industry and indeed natural gas prices and things like that. But unlike in places like Europe or America, where lower oil prices directly lead to lower petrol prices, it's like a sort of stimulation or putting money back into consumers' pockets, a little bit like an interest rate cut, really. That has not happened here in China because the government-owned monopolies have not cut the petrol price by anywhere near the amount that you've seen prices fall in America and Europe.
Angus Grigg. Amongst the concerns about the potential knock-on effects of low oil prices are cuts to investment by oil companies. And with a number of drilling companies, for example, heavily financed, worries too about credit markets. Is it a worry for Jeffrey Yu and his colleagues?
We're noticing clients worrying about it, but to cite a well-worn phrase, and what else is new, right? Now, this has been a problem for over a year now, ever since oil prices started on a severe downtrend when it became clear that OPEC was not going to cut production in an attempt to squeeze out the shale producers. Two things have happened. Basically, one, shale producers have been able to adapt. So, failures and the actual restrictions in supply, or the taking off of supply, has probably been much lower than anticipated, clearly lower than what OPEC has anticipated. That's the first point. But the second point, just talking about OPEC countries themselves, like we look at the high yield market, for example, and that impact, but like Saudi Arabia, they are having to start to liquidate their investments in U.S. equity markets, fixed income markets, to pay for domestic spending because their oil revenues are falling off. So now the latter, given the size of their investments with the GCC, Russia and Norges investment management in Norway, for example, and these are some of the world's largest sovereign wealth funds, if they begin to liquidate en masse, that could be much more problematic in terms of liquidity provision. So it's just not the U.S. high yield sector we should be looking at. For OPEC, who are trying to crowd out these types, they may be doing themselves more damage in the longer term.
Christopher Swan is a cross-asset strategist for the Chief Investment Office at UBS. What does he make of these worries?
I think there are several financial transmission mechanisms here. Like energy companies have been punching way above their weight in terms of investment. We've been in a quite low capital investment environment. And in 2014, energy companies worldwide accounted for about 30% of global capital spending. That's by far the largest of any sector, and about $891 billion in that year. A lot of that was financed by a debt. And we have started to see the default rate among U.S. energy companies rising quite considerably. Among the high-yield issuers, that default rate was about 8% over the past 12 months, and that should rise to about 15% over the coming year, according to UBS forecasts.
Here's a view from the United States. In Chicago is Kevin Allison, columnist at Reuters Breaking Views. Our investment cuts are a real problem.
If oil stays around $30 for a long time, there's going to be significant pain in parts of the economy. The oil and gas sector and the related service companies in the U.S. employ about 650,000 people. That's a lot. Those companies are now firing workers. They're cutting capex. They're buying fewer things. They're buying less steel. They're buying less cement. They're buying less equipment. And I think you're already seeing that reflected in the stock market, in moves by companies that provide this kind of equipment to cut jobs and so on. So there's undoubtedly an effect. It's very focused in certain industries, and it's offset, or should be offset, by a more diffuse but still very real benefit across the entire consumer landscape. So lower oil prices, lower fuel prices eventually act like a tax cut for people. It's hard to see at the individual level, but it does boost disposable incomes. And I think certain things that you see in the economy are evidence of that. U.S. car sales, for example, have been taking off. They were a record in 2015, and people are buying more expensive SUVs as oil prices fall. So you're seeing that uptick in consumption.
Taking a step further back and looking at the big picture in terms of wider investment flow implications, let's hear next from Jeffrey Yu.
Well, big picture, just investment into shale, for example, that clearly is not going to prove economic. All in energy and commodities in general right now, such investment is not going to prove economic until we get a major supply contraction or demand picks up, right, be it from China or the U.S. consumer or any other, major source of demand. So, that's one side of things which would probably limit the investment flow. On the second side of things, the investment flow from OPEC, from the sovereign wealth funds in the past, they were, we should say a net source of liquidity, investment liquidity into global asset markets. That is no longer the case either. And thirdly, we've got the Federal Reserve and beginning to gently normalize and tightening rates. And a lot of people are questioning whether the Fed is actually moving at the right pace in the right direction. And for now, we think the Fed is still, judging by their commentary, at least during last month's FOMC, they're comfortable with the current situation. But all of these pressures put together are probably generating fears that investment fund supply is really going to start to dry up.
Next up on the program, we're considering some geopolitical implications. Will low oil necessarily lead to cuts in government spending from the likes of Russia or the Gulf states even, like Saudi Arabia? Does this concern Paul Donovan?
We are seeing already a number of governments coming under significant fiscal pressure. Reportedly, the Saudi Arabians had a budget deficit of almost $100 billion last year, and they're now looking for ways to cut government spending. In the United Arab Emirates, there's been talk of some of the Emirates actually raising taxes in order to try and meet the budget deficit. And of course, it's not just the oil producers necessarily that are affected. A country like Dubai, which is not particularly an oil producer, is going to be affected because it's going to get less oil tourism, tourists coming and spending the oil revenues that they have. So there are quite widespread implications from all of this. One of the consequences, which is starting to get quite a bit of attention, is that a number of the central banks and sovereign wealth funds in the Gulf region do seem to be selling overseas assets and bringing that money back home to help plug their budget deficits. So one of the consequences of the lower oil price today does seem to be sales of US and some European assets in order to help finance budget deficits in oil-producing countries.
We asked the same question of Christopher Swan.
I guess with most of these countries, there is an implicit quid pro quo, which is in return for having somewhat inferior representative rights in the political system, you have a very paternalistic state, which doles out very generous benefits, particularly in the Gulf region. Obviously, whenever you have a major fall in the oil price, that comes under strain, even in countries like Saudi Arabia, which has huge reserves to cope with situations like this. The fiscal deficits that we're starting to see are pretty alarming. So obviously it's not sustainable over the ultra long term. The hope of Saudi Arabia obviously is that they can drive some of the higher cost oil producers out of business and that the oil price will ultimately return to a more sustainable level.
There's always a challenge when trying to factor in risk in terms of geopolitics. What does Simon Smiles make of the problem when it comes to some of the countries we've been discussing?
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned geopolitical risks. I mean, typically geopolitical risks have derailed, or geopolitics has derailed markets, where it's led to sharp spikes in oil price. Ironically, geopolitics is playing a role in the ever-continued oversupply of the market, which has led to the sharp fall in oil prices this time round, which has different ramifications, such as the ones you're highlighting. On the situation in Saudi Arabia with respect to the fiscal deficit, there's still large commitments post-Arab Spring with respect to social spending. The previously unthought of potential for Aramco to be listed, which has been highlighted, the need to raise debt. You know, all of these signals of significant stress, not just in Saudi Arabia, but across the wider region. Russia, the sharper depreciation of the ruble, obviously placing stress there. The one thing I would highlight, of course, though, is a sharply weaker ruble, actually given the oil imports that Russia benefits from, does actually have an offsetting impact to them, i.e. it, despite the oil price falling, in ruble terms it hasn't fallen to the same degree. So yes, it's something we factor in. It's something we're keeping a cautious eye on. While we expect the Saudi peg to be maintained, you know, there are a number of clients I'm talking to who are looking at various pegs related to commodity prices, you know, be it the Saudi peg, be it the Kuwaiti peg, is particularly coming under stress from continued low oil prices. And I'd highlight that is in our house view that those pegs will be abandoned, but it's definitely more of a topic of conversation among the client base currently.
And finally, in terms of geopolitical implications, are cuts in government spending from some of these countries we've been talking about a concern in China? Well, in fact, it could give China a degree of leverage, explains Angus Grigg.
I think it makes China more powerful, actually, because it gives them, in a time of, you know, an oversupply of oil, it gives China greater leverage over the likes of Russia and Iran and other Middle Eastern countries, because they're the big buyer. China is the one that is importing oil. So we're already seeing some wobbles in talks between China and Russia over gas pipelines and things like that, and oil deals and whether they'll go ahead. So I think from a geopolitical standpoint, I think China's standing or China's sort of ability to exercise power is enhanced by probably lower oil prices.
Another sector that could find itself under increasing pressure in the face of an ongoing oil price slump is renewable energy. If there's a pressure on renewables, could this consequently have a negative environmental impact too? Is it rather too soon to look at and try and assess the downward pressure of low oil, in Christopher Swan's opinion?
Well, it's a possibility. There are two ways in which the oil price would affect renewable firms. In a direct sense, I suppose you have things like electric cars. There has been some sense that some indication that Americans are once again going for huge gas-guzzling vehicles. So sales of big trucks have gone up and smaller, more efficient cars have not been selling so well. In terms of electric vehicles, it's harder to see an impact at the moment just because many of these were already ultra-high-end. So the people who were buying them were not buying them because they wanted to save on petrol bills or anything like that. In terms of electricity, there is a link between, obviously, not a lot of petrol is ever used to produce electrical energy, but the oil price is very much linked to the natural gas price, and the natural gas price has been extremely weak too. That does make solar energy and other more environmentally friendly sources of energy less economical.
In Chicago, what does Kevin Allison think the challenges for renewables might look like?
In the very long run, if oil stays very low and if governments don't follow through on the pledges they made in Paris to try to combat global emissions by raising the price of carbon, I think this is a great opportunity with low oil prices benefiting consumers for governments to consider things like raising gasoline taxes to try to ensure that the price of fuel is at a certain level that does continue to encourage the kind of renewable growth that these governments want in order to reach these Paris targets.
Certainly, the differences between renewables and fossil fuels are interesting, but the pressure on the former may not be quite as intense as you might suppose. Paul Donovan explains more.
The difference between carbon-based fuels and renewable fuels is an interesting one. And I think that whilst the drop in the oil price probably does put some pressure on the renewable sector, it may not be as large as one might suppose. And that is because I think that the debate about renewables over the course of the last 10, 15 years has shifted. And there is a lot more focus on environmental issues, pollution, climate change and other factors in many parts of the world. So I think that it is unlikely that European countries or China, for example, will pull back substantially on their focus on renewables as a result of the lower oil price, because it's more than just pure economics. There's a whole issue around health and the environment which has really captured the popular attention.
And that's Paul Donovan bringing us to the end of this 70th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. On next week's programme, we'll be exploring paid currencies, so be sure not to miss that. In the meantime, you can listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up as ever via iTunes. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.